the computer will tell you how many times you charged your battery, what level the battery was at, exactly, when it was charged for each cycle. If there is a problem, is it in the computer head? Is it in the wiring harness? Mm-hmm. Is it in the battery or is it in the motor?
Right.
And it's boom, boom, boom. You could connect a bike to Giant out in California, mm-hmm, and they can look at our software, right, and that bike that we're working on and tell us, okay, we'll send you a battery or we'll send you a motor, or if it's under warranty, you know.
Right.
So the technology has just gone through the roof.
The N Plus One, global yet very local cycling podcast, brought to you by Lowland Cycling.
Okay, and welcome to Lowland Cycling Podcast. My name is Jerry De Bruin. I've got my co-host with me, Jeff. And today we have a very special guest, local bike shop, Bob. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate it.
All right, great. And this is our first in-person interview that we've done from my garage, so it looks a little different from my usual studio. But thanks for coming, Bob.
No problem.
And so for all of our listeners, can you just give us a history of how you got started in the bicycle industry?
It all started with a knee injury in wrestling. I wrestled in high school, wrestled in college, and my summer between the 2 years that I was in school, I went to a two-year community college for business major, and I was in a summer tournament, and I blew my knee out. And the doctor said, swim or bike. Mm. So I got my cast off in late September. That was on from July through the summer and to the middle of September. The cast came off and I joined a swim club in college, never swam competitively. And we wound up competing against some local junior colleges, but it helped rehab my knee. And when I got out of the pool, I bought a bike.
Nice.
And the doctor said, you either swim or bike, because the injury I had was not conducive to running anymore. They said all low impact. Mm. And as it turns out, that's when my knee feels the best, is when I'm on the bike, and I don't swim anymore. But
yeah,
I watch my daughter swim. They're on the team, the high school team.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've had a lot of interview guests that have said the same thing. They came into cycling from injury because it is so low impact and it is therapeutic, right? Bringing more blood flow to whatever has been injured. We've seen that as a common thread, right?
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And lucky for the cycling industry that it's a rehabilitation type of workout. So that's pretty good.
Well, as we get into this a little more, I guess we'll talk about my career with wholesale and retail, but I attended a national sales meeting for Giant Bicycles, and the owner of Giant Global was at our meeting, and he did a PowerPoint presentation of knee operations, hip operations, and he pointed to the board and said, that's what's going to keep us busy in the future.
Wow.
Right.
Because everybody's getting their knees done, their hips done because of high impact injuries, and we'll always be busy because of the low impact that cycling has.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
Right. All right. So how did you get started with the bicycle industry?
Well, when I bought my bike, I got on the bike after I got out of the pool, and I started riding with actually, a guy I commuted to college with, his father and his uncle rode every night. Mm. They did 25 to 35 miles, depending on the time of year. We'd ride long, they would ride later in the evenings. But I started riding with them and rode almost every night. And then on the weekends, we got into doing metric centuries and centuries. And from the time I was 19, 20, until I was about 25, I did just more distance cycling. And eventually I went away on a vacation trip with those three guys, my college friend who I commuted with, his uncle and his father, and we went away to Vermont, to Vermont bicycle touring. And we took a 5-day vacation from end to end, and I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And I actually booked a trip for the end of the summer there, and I booked the trip specifically near the office of the company that I went to.
Okay.
And I went in and actually interviewed on the spot, walked in and said, I want to come to work for you next year. What do I have to do to get this job? So he said, go back and, you know, make up a resume and mail it to us and whatnot. So I did my resume that weekend when I did another weekend trip that weekend, and I handed it to the tour leaders, made sure they gave it to him that next Monday, called him back when I drove home from Vermont Sunday night. I called him Monday morning, said, I wanted to make sure you got my resume.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I got your resume. It's right here. I'm reading it in the trip kit. You must really want this job. So next year we'll bring you up and we'll put you to work.
Wow.
So that was my first job in the bike industry. And that was actually also the same time that next summer that I learned a lot of mechanical things. The business had over 400 bikes that they used for fleet, for rentals, because they ran 2-day, 3-day, 5-day trips, usually 5 long trips going throughout the state of Vermont, all end to end. But they had 5 Dodge Maxi vans, 3,500 vans. They took all the passenger seats out and they were loaded with the rental bikes.
Right.
So as a tour leader, you would drive to an inn, a starting point, and you would do big loops. So you'd ride from end to end to end to end, stay at 4 different places throughout the week.
Right.
And come back to the last one the last night. But those vans, we'd load them up with bikes for all the tours. And they all had to be gone over before they went back out on trips. Flats had to be fixed, spokes needed to be replaced, wheels needed to be trued, cables needed to be fixed or whatever. But back then it was just 10-speed, 12-speed Motobacons, or I think they used Peugeots even back then.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That was in 1979 that I had that job.
That friction was shifting then, huh?
Friction shifting.
Yeah.
No index.
You just pull the lever and just find the gear.
Pull the lever, and when the chain stopped rattling, you knew you were in gear.
That's right.
Not like today.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great start. Going through Vermont, like how long were those days when you were doing those trips?
You could do, they did trips that were called weekenders, vagabonds, and wanderers. The weekenders were just like you would go up on a Friday night, you'd ride Saturday, you'd stay at the same inn, you'd do a loop, maybe a northern loop, and they'd have 3 different routes. You could do a 25, a 45, or a 60-mile ride, depending on your level of fitness and your capabilities on the bike. But up there, you were either going up or you're going down.
Right.
So it was, as a Flatlander coming from Flat, New Jersey, where I grew up, I got in shape pretty quick. Within the first 30 days, I was climbing like a billy goat.
Yeah.
And I had a front chain ring that was, a 42-52.
Yeah.
Not a compact 34-50 like there is today.
Right.
And the cassette or the freewheel back then, the low on that was a 28.
Yeah.
And there weren't a lot of options to change your gearing. So you just got stronger.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I was a lot younger then too, so it came easier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I went from that trip to coming home and applying for a job in a local bike shop in Haddonfield, New Jersey. It was a place called the Peddler Shop, and wound up working there. And 9 years later, went to Settlement to buy the business.
Right.
And that didn't work out, so I left retail back then and went into wholesale, starting with Diamondback Bicycles.
Oh, okay.
When Diamondback was a company that was sold directly to independent bike shops. It was called Western States Imports. So they were selling Diamondback and Dave Scott Centurions.
Oh yeah.
Dave Scott was the first real US triathlete that launched the road bike market.
Right.
So
yeah, didn't he have a whole line of products too?
Yeah. They had all, he they came out with tri bars back then. They were clip-ons, but
yeah,
you know, a lot of it's changed over the years. But yeah, Dave and well, we also sold through those years in the 80s. The industry had a lot of smaller distributors that were importing bikes from France, Japan. Right. Back then you had Motobukan, Peugeot, you had Fuji, you had Panasonic,
right.
All those older brand names.
Yeah.
And we at times had 5 to 7 brands of bicycles in our store. Yeah. Raleigh from England, and it was from England. It was from a factory in Carlton, the Raleigh Carlton factory.
Right.
And occasionally we still see those bikes come in. I've seen a lot of, in the recent months with the COVID stuff going on, people bringing in bikes that were 75, 74 yeah. through 80s. Brand new bikes with dry rotted tires and wow. rusted cables. Yeah, they pulled out of their garages.
My first bike that I bought, I don't know, when I was 15 or 16, after I kind of wore out my dad's old race bike, was a Panasonic. Mm-hmm. And it was because of the Panasonic cycling team, the pro team, which came after the TI Rally. And the funny thing is that the TI Rally bike, the steel bike, they have a limited edition from the factory in the UK nowadays that they are selling.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can go online and you can buy, I think it's around $3,000, something like that.
Yeah.
But you can buy a, let's say, original steel TI Rally bike.
Right.
In the same colors, the same Mavic wheels. It's a pretty cool bike. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I believe back then, Connie Carpenter Finney, Dave's Finney, and Alexi Graywall mm-hmm. were sponsored. Raleigh was their bike in the Olympics in the 80s.
Right.
Back then.
Right.
I think they were hand-built, right?
Yeah, they were hand-built.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Harry Havnunian had anything to do with some of those bikes.
Let's check the rear brake.
Yeah. Yeah,
right. So speaking of changes in technology, we've seen a lot of bad technologies over the years. We've seen things from suspension stems.
The Girvan Flex stem.
Girvan Flex stem, yeah. We've had Shamal wheels. Remember Campy came out with these?
Yeah.
Or, no, that was the Mavic, right?
Shamal? Mavic, yeah.
Yeah. And then even Shimano had a Rapid Rise derailleur, which went in reverse order. So it would just always be in the easiest gear and you have to pull it down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they did that for a while and that bombed out.
And we're still fixing those bikes today. You can still get the derailleurs. We
really?
Have them.
Oh, really?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Because we're having to replace them.
Yeah.
And we just got 2 in today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're working on a bike today, an older Raleigh
wow.
that had Rapid Rise and it was twist shift.
Yeah, grip shift.
You know, it's the recreational hybrid type bike that had it on there. But yeah, that was. Well, the Dior XT, you had to paddle. You shifted with your brake lever.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
which we still see them today.
Wow.
All those shifters come back in and they don't work because they're all gummed up. All the grease inside the mechanisms are all gummed up and, you know, the paws in there stay open and
right.
you can't shift them.
And it is, the people are bringing them in because they just want to get their bike back in working order. Or is it also because people want to build up their, let's say, retro bike because they have some memories from the past?
Yeah, there's a lot of emotional attachment to some old bikes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we see it all the time. This was my bike in college, or this was my bike when I was a kid. We've seen some old Schwinns from the 60s too, the 50s and 60s, that people are cleaning up and, you know, revamping.
Right.
They always give them to me because I know that technology, being the old guy in the store.
Yeah.
But they're fun to work on.
Right.
Sometimes they're a lot easier to fix.
Yeah.
Because of the, you know, there's, you don't have the precise tolerances in the shifting and whatnot as the newer bikes.
Yeah.
Right.
But.
Yeah, if you get one of Jeff's bikes in, it's You need to download a software program.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
firmware
even...
Firmware updates.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even Steve Tilford, who was, you know, he was racing in the 80s. He said 10-speed was pretty much the height of technology. Like, that's when things were the best, when it was least finicky, best amount of gears, best shifting. And then 11-speed, it went downhill.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
So do you look at things in the industry now and think, that's going to be a fad? Or
Well, I've seen, because I've been doing this so long, I've seen the fads. You can, or sometimes you when I was a factory rep for Giant and even Diamondback, we would go to product meetings and we'd see the new product for the next year. We'd get a, you know, 3 to 4 month window before they started shipping the bikes to dealers, and we'd see the product and we'd be like, how are they going to outdo this for next year with the suspension design or the shifting with the electronic shifting and all that stuff came, all the new technology comes from the top end down, has a trickle down effect. So we just wonder when we're going to see 105 DI, but I don't know.
Yeah. 105 DI2, I think that's going to be the end of mechanical shifting.
Yeah.
When that comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah, although, and then we talked about it before, is that you also hear people that are going back to mechanical because they have some issues or they lost a cable to the charger.
Right.
And then get annoyed with it and say, okay, the heck with it, I want to go back to mechanical. It's it's more reliable. Mm-hmm. But I think it will take a little bit more time before everybody really gets over it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think, like, 2 years ago the pro field was fighting disc brakes, right, and they were saying, oh, they're spinning, you know, razor blades, like no one's gonna want to do this, and now it's like everyone's using discs, right?
Yeah
two years later.
Yeah. You can go ride your bike faster.
Yeah,
better braking down the mountains.
Absolutely
right. Yeah, that is an interesting topic, maybe to discuss later, because even in the Tour de France, the Jumbo-Visma team choose to use the rim brakes. And I think the reason behind that was when you get a flat, it's easier, and again, to more reliable to change out a wheel. Mm-hmm. Compared to taking the whole bike basically off the rooftop, and not every rider has their own bike on the rooftop, right? Only the top
elite,
guys.
Elite team, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then you have the through axle.
Right. Yeah,
the through axle
exactly.
To make the bike stiffer, but it's a lot more to take that bike off, that wheel off.
Yeah.
To do a tire change or whatever. Yeah.
That jump out of the car, and it's like a Formula One, right? They have this small battery charged, and they take the true axle out and then they put it back in. Yeah.
So I remember back in the 80s, like, there was bad bike brands, right? Like, you would just stay away from some things because you ride it and it just didn't have the soul of like another bike. But nowadays it seems like you can hop on pretty much any brand and they're all pretty fantastic.
Oh yeah.
It comes down to really rider preference at a certain point. Do you think that is eating into some of these custom built bikes because the average bike is so good?
Yeah, I mean, there's such a diverse product offering. Mm-hmm. With mountain bikes, hardtail, full suspension, dropper posts, almost everything now comes with disc brakes. I mean, one of our companies, Giant, is making one bike with rim brakes. And it's at a $450 price point, but just an entry level. All the kids' bikes, they even have disc brakes on some of the 24-inch wheel bikes. And there are 20-inch bikes that have disc brakes. Well, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you get into the different segments of the industry with flat bar fitness, we call them sport fitness bikes. They're mm-hmm. more of a road bike with flat bars. They might have a triple, but the industry is starting to move away from the triples back to doubles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 2x. in the entry level price points, but then they're going to one buys, which means one chain ring up front and 10, 11 sprockets in the rear, sometimes 12 now.
Right.
But they'll make them in carbon. They'll make them with carbon fork aluminum frame. They'll make them with different levels. Every company has competitive price points with their specs, but you know, we've seen the industry go from a lot of brands mm-hmm. down to the three major players,
right.
which are Trek, Giant, and Specialized,
right.
and not necessarily in that order.
Right.
But throughout my career, I've actually seen that all change from the French and the English and the, you know, the Japanese technology or, you know, manufacturing to going to... back when Trek was an American company, like they were trying to make all their bikes in the US for
right.
7 or 8 years, and they really couldn't compete labor-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And Giant Bicycles came along and they started contracting out with Giant Bicycles.
Right.
So now they, you know, they're manufacturing frames for Trek since 1987. But Giant right now is the largest manufacturer of quality bikes in the world. I think they are at now up to about 12 factories globally,
mm-hmm.
and they're producing bikes in, they actually just started and opened up a factory, and their first production runs came out of Hungary, in Hungary for European, and
yeah.
they're filling the pipeline for the European
right.
distribution centers there. They've got a factory in Europe for pedal assist electric bikes,
mm-hmm.
and they also have a factory there for pedal bikes.
Right.
When I was a rep for Giant Bicycles in the late 90s, mid-90s, we would always ask Tony Low, who's the original founder of Giant Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Tony spent 6 months in the U.S. traveling with all the sales reps, and he went from the East Coast to the West Coast and visited five different days with reps, meeting dealers, finding what they wanted, what they liked, what they didn't like. And he was the interim president of Giant USA for 6 months
right.
and traveled and met all the reps and all the dealers mm-hmm. that he could to get their feedback. And Tony, we'd all ask him, when can we get a factory here in the U.S.?
Right.
Because if we had Giant mm-hmm. made in the U.S., that's a big kudos mm-hmm. for a brand being made in the U.S.
Yeah.
And he said, when you can sell 500,000 frames a year consistently for that one brand, we could possibly do a factory there. But you also have all the components to go mm-hmm. on the bikes.
Right.
So you need the, you know, the wheels and the handlebars and the stems and the component warehouses to fill mm-hmm. the, you know, to build the bikes. And the U.S. is unfortunately car-driven, car-centric.
Right.
So not like the Netherlands and Europe
yeah.
and how they commute and they use a bike as a utilitarian
mm-hmm. right.
vehicle. So that's why there would never be a factory here building mm-hmm. frames in the U.S. There's small factories, small manufacturers, little niche brands here and there.
Yeah.
And custom builders, but nothing on a mass.
No, not exactly. Yeah, 500,000 bikes is a lot, but... when you compare it with the Netherlands or other companies, most people have one, two, or three bikes.
Right.
You have one.
Well, we tell everybody they should.
Yeah,
it's a bike shop.
You have your commuter bike. You have your bike to go out in the dirt or gravel, and it's there's a lot of bikes around. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And our garages can only hold so many.
I know. Although I do have extra hooks, so. So what changes have you seen in the bike shop, like in the bike industry, like since COVID hit?
Oh, well, we're just very careful about letting people in the store. We've been adamant about cleanliness. We have hand sanitizer all over for everyone to use. We're spending more money on masks and gloves and wipes and things. We sanitize and wipe down all the bikes that we touch. We wipe down all the handlebars and anything, touch points, seats, grips, and all that.
Right.
So we have to have more supplies there with that. It's created what I totally never expected, a boom. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest boom ever in the bicycle industry right now. I've lived through being in retail. I've lived through transit strikes. I've lived through odd even gas rationing when people brought bikes out to commute with back then in the late 70s, early 80s, and transit strikes in Philadelphia that affected people from New Jersey. I worked in a store in New Jersey for my first 10 years after I left Vermont, came home. But the transit strike drove all the people to bring in their bikes for repairs.
Right.
And there were booms on repair work over the years. That, you know, was consistent. But I never expected having people coming to the door, calling and calling and calling and calling, and us selling 30 to 35 bikes a day during the week this past summer, to the point now where we've run out of product.
Right.
Where globally, there's such a boom on outdoor products.
Mm-hmm.
You can't buy kayaks. You can't buy fishing rods. You can't buy, you have to order them.
Right.
You can't buy a desk because kids are home from school.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
The desks.
Yeah. Yep.
But anything outdoors. And, you had your health clubs closed. You had your Y's and the gyms and all that closed up. And we had parents calling in May, do you guys have any bikes? I want to get these kids out of my hair, get them out of the house and get on the trail. But we're seeing a lot more families get together and ride together. And I just hope that they're going to stay with it and
keep
going.
Yeah.
Right.
The advent too, we were asking about changes. NICA, National Interscholastic Cycling Association, 5 or 6 years ago, I think now, Pennsylvania started their league. And that's created a nice boom here with mountain bikes, kids on mountain bikes. And what's really nice about it is middle school kids can be involved in sixth grade, seventh grade, and eighth grade. And I heard from some of the teams that that's their biggest segment. And since that is their biggest segment, that means that those kids, if they really fall in love with it, are going to stay with it.
Right.
And, into the mountain bike. And I'd like to see road bikes, boom like that, but I don't know that that'll happen.
Yeah.
The kids can be in the woods and they're safe.
Exactly.
That's
the biggest point, right? It's a safe.
Yeah. It's been interesting because I think the cycling industry has really come out of this ahead. You see more people on trails. You see the kids riding, then the parents want to ride. So it's good for the whole family to get out there and do it. My kids are both skiers and they're at the age now where skiing is free for any fourth and fifth graders.
Right.
So I was going to go get them some skis and they said, oh, we're not doing that program. And there's a limited amount of people on the mountains. So you have to really get a season pass and then try to schedule it the day before, but it may be sold out. And it's not going to bring kids in, whereas you get them a bike, they have all these trails around here.
Yeah.
It's so much easier for them. So it has been interesting to see what sports have thrived, and I feel like cycling is one of them.
Yeah. Well, the infrastructure that we have now and hopefully in the future, if we can connect Exton area to Downingtown and then Downingtown north, that would be great with the bike paths.
Right.
Having that bike path right out back from our shop has been, a godsend because we've been able to do rentals. We haven't since all this started because we rent fairly new bikes. Used bikes disappeared like in April and we only could take so many of those in. We don't have a lot of room for storage for used bikes and repairs and whatnot. But, we've seen, since the pipeline is thinned out with new product, repairs are just booming. Today we brought in 8 or 9 and yesterday 10 or 12 and the day before. So it's been 70 to 80 bikes a week coming through the door to get repairs, get fixed.
Wow.
And it's older product, it's older 80s, 90s, early 2000s bikes. But yeah, the service is where it's at right now. Mm-hmm. And that's been, it's a shame because the industry years ago, you could see almost 10,000 bike shops across the country.
Right.
That were like we are, mm-hmm. a small independent store. And even up until the mid-80s, you saw a branded store, and it was Schwinn.
Right.
And Schwinn was the concept store of the past. Mm-hmm. And there were, I think there was statistically, I think there were 7,000 or 8,000 Schwinn dealers.
Right.
Now the industry is down to, because of all the other outside availability with the internet, with big box stores, mm-hmm. with, you know, stores like Dick's and, well, Sports Authority's not around anymore, but Walmart, everybody carrying the lower end product, that's basically whittled bike shops down to around 4,000 to 5,000 bike shops, mm-hmm. in the, you know, in owners around the country. There are some large independent dealers who have multiple locations. But there's also a trend in the industry where manufacturers are starting to move into retail.
Right.
For instance, Trek has taken over the bike line stores.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And Trek's doing that throughout the industry in different markets.
Right.
And that you can't blame them because they're trying to secure the market share, mm-hmm. of where they are.
Right.
Years ago, I traveled with one of the executives who left Schwinn to start Giant USA. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting at a traffic light up in, I think it was near Doylestown or 309 up that way, Bucks County. And we're sitting at a light and he looked over and he said, "You see that car dealership over there? It's Ford, Lincoln, Mercury." He said, "You're going to see that in the bike industry 10, 15, 20 years from now."
Right.
It'll be, you're going to have Giant, Trek, and Jamis, or, you know, Specialized, Raleigh, and, you know, two or three brands. Whereas back in the 80s, we had five or six.
Right.
But you can't be everything to everybody. And
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the manufacturers, they kind of put pressure on the dealer network also, and they have over the years, to carry more floor space. Mm-hmm. You need to have 80% of our bicycles and, you know, 50 to 70% of our products, mm-hmm. our helmets and locks and pumps and things like that. So the independent, from the independent bike shop, has kind of gone by the wayside somewhat. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's the way the industry goes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So where do you see the bike shops in 5 years if we continue on this trend?
I see, well, there's, you know, you can go in your house tonight at 12 o'clock and buy a bike online. Any of the brands we carry, it has to come to our store, though. They're not giving up on the dealer network. They want the bikes professionally assembled, mm-hmm. And legally, I guess they want to cover their butts to make sure that the bikes are not going to get put together the wrong way. They're, you know, it, you got to have somebody that knows what they're doing with the bike, with the technology there is, and just making sure every nut and bolt is tightened and greased and done properly.
Right.
You know, 5 years from now, I think you're still going to see a lot of service. Over the past 10 years, I've seen and read more about, not necessarily right in our area, but around the country, a lot of stores doing a lot of used product. So the retail landscape has changed because real estate has gone up so high that landlords need to, you know, pinch you more for rent and things. And if you don't own your building, it's a shame. I've seen some really good dealers over the years come and go because they just couldn't afford the the real estate.
Yeah, that the whole real estate stuff is crazy. And if you look in our area, right, there's so much empty space. But I guess they won't budge in lowering the rent,
right?
So that's...
but we still see a lot of people that want to come in the store. They want to, you know, be fit. They want to be, you know, they want to test ride.
Right.
And I tell everybody when they come in and they thank us, I'm like, that's why you come to a bike shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can educate you. You can go buy it online, but, you know, good luck putting it together or, you know, having it. We'll take care of it. I mean, we do stuff all the time. People bring things in all the time. I was telling Jeff about a guy who brought a stem in today that was not for his bike, but he bought it online because he wanted to sit more upright.
Right.
But we had something that would work for him. I said, just return that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So on e-bikes, last week, a e-bike, it was a startup company, it was from the Netherlands, so that's why it drew my eye, but it got an investment of $40 million dollars from a US company, and it's a regular commuter type of e-bike that they have, and one of the thoughts behind it is that they see an increase in demand on e-bikes, obviously, but there are also more and more lease a bike concepts starting to arise at a really low rate. Are those things that you kind of see developing first from an e-bike point of view? How is that market developing and almost like creativity around, okay, what to do with bikes?
Yeah. Yeah. We've seen our numbers quadruple over last year.
Right.
And I mean, they weren't big numbers in the past, but funny story. The first company to come out with a bike, an electric bike, was Giant Bicycles. And it was in 1994. And I was the factory rep then. And the person who actually drove Giant to push these bikes more was Lee Iacocca, the owner of General Motors.
Oh, okay.
Because the federal government was pushing car dealerships to have at least 5% of their inventory to be electric vehicles. And for him to get around the loophole of having flooring bikes that are cars that they didn't really have, he brought in electric bikes.
Okay.
So I was calling on car dealerships and teching the guys on how to sell these electric bikes.
Yeah.
That only lasted a year or two. And those bikes were nightmares. They were lead acid batteries. They were heavy.
Yeah.
The bikes weighed 75 or 80 pounds. The wiring harnesses were all separate from the computer, all the little control panels and things. And they were nightmares to diagnose and fix.
Right.
Today, you can take an electric bike from Giant or Specialized that we carry, and I believe Trek is the same. You can wheel it up next to a computer through Bluetooth technology, basically upload the software to that bike, and that the computer will tell you how many times you charged your battery, what level the battery was at, when it was charged for each cycle. If there is a problem, is it in the computer head, is it in the wiring harness, is it in the battery, or is it in the motor?
Right.
And it's boom, boom, boom. You could connect a bike to Giant out in California, and they can look at our software and that bike that we're working on and tell us, okay, we'll send you a battery, or we'll send you a motor, or if it's under warranty, you know.
Right.
So the technology has just gone through the roof, and bikes are gotten so much lighter. We're selling a Specialized that's $3,500, $3,800 right now, and the bike weighs 35 pounds.
Wow.
And it's a hybrid commuter style bike, but they have the road bikes that are even lighter.
Right.
So, and it's every segment too that we're seeing. We're seeing guys coming in buying full suspension mountain bikes that are electric pedal assist, and we only sell pedal assist, so they're torque sensored. So you can actually control the level of assist that you get and battery usage better that way.
Right.
So you can go ride further. You know, those old Giant, they called them LaFries back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. You could go 20, 30 miles on a charge. Now you can ride a bike on low level assist and go 75 to 80 miles on a charge on a battery. And they're all lithium ion and
lot lighter. Quick charge. Yeah.
Yeah.
The past weekend were the World Championships mountain bike, and you had e-bike, the first
category,
and Sven Nys, he competed in that, so the world champion cyclocross, so that was interesting. I actually don't know what he did or how
he didn't
how
win. He didn't win. There was another kid that won, under 23 kid that won.
Oh, okay.
Well, we have some great stories in this area. There's some young guys who are motocross racers,
right?
But they bought $5,000 full suspension bikes to ride the courses.
Oh, really?
To get familiar with the courses on their mountain bikes.
Yeah.
To save on their motorcycle. You know, they had their motorcycle dialed in and tuned, and they didn't want to mess with it. So they ride the courses with their mountain bikes.
Okay.
Wow. We had a woman today buy a bike. Her daughter is in some dressage cross country horse event, and they're coming cross country with horses, and she wants to ride an electric bike 2 or 3 days out of the week with the group
right.
That's coming across country through the different events. So it's grown exponentially in the last year for us. And it's more older couples too. We had some holdout husbands who said, that's for my wife.
Yeah.
And then they couldn't keep up with their wife. So they came back and got themselves a bike. But there's been nice growth in this area. Actually, the newer buildings they built right over here, there was a woman who moved here from North Jersey to be closer to her daughter, and she bought a bike, an electric bike. It was a $2,000 giant LeFree, I think, she got. And she got all these people like seeing her, wow, that's a really nice bike. And we got more people just in that development.
Exactly.
It's more of a retirement building over there. And she's like, this is so great. It's been great for my social life. So I'm like, good. Keep telling more people about it.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, bring them in. And that's,
but it's what cycling's about. It's for fun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think I don't know if I told you, but one of my racing buddies, Stefan Kincaid, who raced for Rite Aid as a pro, he's on the Stan's website, you know, he's in all the photos and stuff. But he got a electric mountain bike, and he's been doing 70-mile rides out in Birdsboro. That he said you cannot ride on an acoustic bike; you have to have an e-bike because the hills are so steep and it's so gnarly that you can't pedal over it. You're either pushing a regular bike or you're riding it on an e-bike.
Yeah.
So he has huge group rides that he does out there. It's it's interesting to see like fit people can just go even harder because of having that pedal assist. You know?
Right. Yeah, and they're having fun doing it.
Right. Definitely something to try.
Did you see, especially during the lockdown, an increase in smart trainers?
Because the weather got nice.
Yeah.
We're starting to now. We're getting more calls. People are calling about Wahoo, or we carry Jet Black. We've sold... In the last 2 weeks, I think we did sell 4 indoor trainers, just the Magneto or a couple fan units and fluid trainers that people are starting to move inside with.
Yeah.
But it's funny, with the technology change, we're getting people that get home with them, and then they're like, oh, I don't have a quick release. I have a through axle. So there's another accessory that we have to sell them with the bike, a through axle adapter to fit the trainer.
Right.
And then there's the situation with getting the right configuration with a cassette on the smart trainers. In the last couple of years, I've had people bring their trainer they bought in online, and they're like, it's not shifting right, or then they didn't tighten down the lock ring for the cassette right, or they don't have the tools to do it. Where they somehow put the cogs on wrong, or upside down or backwards, and you know, but you take care of them and you move on.
Yeah. So so you've been in the industry for quite a while. So who could you describe like who the best bike customers are and who the worst bike customers are?
Oh wow, you're gonna put me on the spot here. The best bike customers. Or the ones who don't know anything about their bike. No. I mean, everybody's different. You have to be a chameleon in retail. Mm-hmm. You know, it's with anything in sales. You gotta understand your customer and take care of them. They I mean, I printed out a sign. It was like, it said it's $20 for us to do it. It's $30 for advice from you to do it. Right. You know, it was kept going up higher and higher and higher, and it's $150 if you touched it yourself. Right. But, you know, it's across the board with, you know, you see guys who they're consistently coming in and their bike is covered with mud.
Yeah. Right.
Would you bring your bike into your house like that?
Right.
You know, but, you know, I mean, we take it outside and we kick the mud off and knock it off and get in there and find out what's wrong with it. Oh, you got mud keeping your derailleur from shifting.
Right.
You know, hose it off once in a while.
Right.
I mean, you see all different kinds of things, you know, every customer is different, but take care of their needs and they keep coming back.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any one, you know, you see that there's people who are very particular, and we had a guy buy an S-Works bike and we never saw a scratch on it. He pulled the cap underneath the bottom bracket off and saw that when you pull that cap off, it pulled a chip of paint with it. Mm-hmm. Specialized took care of him. He sent the frame back. We stripped the bike down and sent the frame back.
Wow.
He didn't want to deal with it with us. And I said, okay, well, we'll take care of it.
Right.
And they took care of him. So, you know, I was, as a rep, I always told people that were in the stores, because people always asked me that. I work for Giant Bicycles.
Right.
Oh, well, what's the best bike? Giant? I said, no, it's the best bike is the bike that you're happy with, that you fit. You know, three big things about a bike: the fit, the color, because you're going to have to live with it, and the comfort. You
right.
know, is it going to feel comfortable? Is it going to do what you want to get out of cycling? Yeah, it's kind of gratifying to see, you know, you see some customers come in and they're like, they're kind of like, they don't want to buy a bike, but they do.
Yeah.
Right.
And they finally do. And then they come back and they're real happy.
Exactly. They're stung by the bug.
Yeah. Right. We have an older group of people in this area. I call them Aunt Carla, Aunt Charlotte, Aunt Barbara. They're the Struble Trail Gang. There's these older women right. in their late 70s who ride all the time, and they've ridden out in the, what's that trail that goes from Pittsburgh down to Washington. They've been all over.
Oh, wow.
The Freedom over. Trail or yeah. the, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
We've seen, you know, people come in that had quadruple bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. The doctor said, you need to do cardio, nothing strenuous, but they went from a $450 upright comfort bike to not liking getting passed on the bike path to buying a carbon $1,500-$1,600 carbon fitness bike.
Right.
And they've gone, they come back and they're like, I'm 5 miles an hour faster, you know?
Yeah.
But they're, you know, they're enjoying it, which is what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. So this last week they announced a Specialized bike that's 13 pounds, that's disc road bike with a power meter. Where do you think in 5 years we're going to be with the weight of bikes and with all the technology advancements?
Well, back in 1991, a kid in our store built a 14 pound Viscount, all aluminum frame, and snapped a spindle on it one night on a ride. But you can build a bike as light as you want. Technology's there to make them stronger, and you know, carbon's the way to go with strength to weight ratio and whatnot. So you can do more of that material than anything.
Right.
So where are we going to be? That's, you know, that's like 3% of the market.
Yeah.
For us.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I mean, there are stores who probably cater to a lot more of that, but that's not our market, you know.
Yeah.
And we'd like it to be. Mm-hmm. And occasionally we get people that come in and say, oh, I want to spend $10,000-$12,000, and they do, but we order it, you know. It's been that way for years with the retail, I think, with the high end. Back in 86, 87, we were flooring bikes that went up to $1,000, you know, and they were like, they were nice bikes, the Schwinn Prelude, the Schwinn, well, we had a Paramount with gold components on it, 24 karat gold components, but that belonged to the owner's son, and that was a showpiece.
Right.
But back then we were selling, I had a woman walk in with Bicycling Magazine and opened it up, and she said, can you get me that bike there? And it was a Campy Record Bottecchia. Mm-hmm. And there was a distributor up in New York who sold them and brought them in. And we ordered the bike for her. And it was a guy, it was for her fiance. This guy came into our store. We did Saturday night rides. Every Saturday, I'd close the store at 5, said, come in before that if you need whatever for your bike. And we're on the road by 5:15, 5:30. We did a 10, a 20, and a 30-mile loop, or 40-mile loop in South Jersey. And this guy showed up on a Huffy Free Spirit. He was your size, your height. He was 300 pounds. And when he came to the store with this bike, he said, yeah, I want to get out and ride with you guys. I said, well, I forget his name, but I said, I'm really sorry. I don't have a tube to fit that. Like, you're going to have to get a tube to fit that size wheel and carry it with you. If something happens, we'll have to get a crescent wrench and undo your wheels, because they were lugged wheel or nutted wheels. But that guy did the ride. He went 5 miles down the road, got a flat, called his fiance, got a ride home. He saw the group of people I had in the parking lot with their bikes and their clothing and this and that. And he came back and he said, I got to lose weight. I want to get better at this. Sell me a bike that's just going to get me started. So he bought a $210 bike, and he lost 70 pounds in 4 or 5 months. He kept riding with us every Saturday night. He got really fit. And his fiance, as a surprise gift for an engagement gift, gave him that Bottecchia.
Wow.
Yeah, she came in and said, can you get that bike? And it was about a $2,500 bike back then.
Right. With
Campy Record and Italian frame.
Talking about the Italian and Campy, I wonder how the Colnago and Campy sales are doing right now after you won the Tour de France. Right.
Well, you know, Italy is, I was looking at a trade magazine, one of the latest ones that just came out last week. Italy has the second most produced bikes in Europe right now.
Yeah.
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 And I think the Netherlands was behind, just behind them.
Yeah.
So, but bike sales globally, I guess, was 1,590,000 were sold 2 years ago, and we're down at about 500,000 though for this year so far, which is kind of a surprise. But I guess we ran out.
Right. Well, probably the factory shutdowns too, right?
Yeah.
The Colnago, it's the first time that they won the Tour de France after all these years that they were in the Tour de France. So that's crazy.
Yeah.
The real story is that it's actually the second time, but the first time that they won, I believe it was Eddie Merckx, and he already had his own brand. So they repainted a Colnago to the Eddie Merckx. So officially it was their frame,
right.
But it was an Eddie Merckx bike.
Wow.
So that's an interesting Wikipedia.
Yeah, right. Right? I think Campagnolo won every tour until Lance. Is that right? Or maybe it was Greg LeMond when he was on the Mavic.
Yeah, LeMond was.
Up until then, it was always Campagnolo.
Campy, yeah.
But those two names you just named, LeMond and
Armstrong,
changed the industry. The road bikes peaked,
right.
Then dropped off.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the compact geometry, compact road bikes came from the mountain bike world. Because the industry, after Le Mans stopped racing, the road bike sales in the U.S. were less, almost like 2% of the market.
Right.
But mountain bikes were booming. And the designer of Chris Boardman's bike, Mike Burrows, developed the first compact road bike with small, medium, and large. And they sold those bikes just in small, medium, large. And we as reps went around and sold our dealers kits with 7 different seat post sizes and 7 different stem sizes.
Right.
So you could adjust the cockpit to fit the rider with 3 frames.
Right.
Because the demand was so low for road. Mm-hmm. And then it took off. And then I had a real nice story to tell when Specialized went to compact road, and when other, what better compliment than to be copied?
Right.
You know, but it made sense. It was less material, it was a smaller frame, less, you know, material, and make it lighter and stiffer and faster.
Right. Yeah. Now you see like a Cannondale with like a horizontal top tube and it looks old fashioned.
The double diamond frame.
Right. Yeah, that's another change. It seems like with the road bikes, there wasn't much advancement for a number of years. And then all of a sudden, everything hit at once. And you have disc, you have tubeless, you have wide, shorter cranks, oval rings.
One by.
Right?
Yeah. Well, we had oval rings back in the 80s.
Yeah, we did.
Biopace, exactly.
And now they're back to oval, wolf tooth, and the chain rings for the mountain bikes.
Yeah.
But, and rotor. Mm-hmm. But, the changes, you know, when you went, I called it going from the friction to the STI, that was like, whoa.
Yeah.
That was a big technological jump there.
Right.
Down tube STI shifters from, you know, friction to, or even bar count or bar end shifters. I still have a bike hanging in the garage with those. That was my cyclocross bike I made up.
Yeah.
My project bike.
Thanks for joining. It was great to have you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Excellent.
It's a wrap.
It's a wrap.
All right.